from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim.
You know I love that organic cooking. I always ask for more. And they call me Mr. Natural. On down to the health food store.
Coming up on Forum, according to San Francisco Chronicle food writer Jonathan Kaufman, chances are you eat like a hippie. That yogurt and granola you had for breakfast, or the alfalfa sprouts in your sandwich on whole wheat bread, all that would have been called hippie food in the 60s and 70s, says Kaufman. He's just written a book looking back more than a half century at the unusual, often ridiculed hippies who changed the way Americans eat. We learn how they did it next on Forum.
Then I pull out a Hostess Twinkie and I pop it in my mouth. Yeah, in the daytime I'm Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. But at night I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Jonathan Kaufman says there's a good chance you can thank hippies in the 1960s and 70s for the foods that figure prominently in your diet today. Whole food bread, perhaps, or maybe brown rice, organic vegetables, tofu, and soy sauce. It's not that hippies necessarily invented all these things, more that they took to these foods and brought them to the mainstream when the corporate food industry was pushing, say, Velveeta Spam or Jell-O. Kaufman's new book is Hippie Food: How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. He's a James Beard award-winning food writer at the San Francisco Chronicle. And Jonathan Kaufman, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, could you just start by reminding us how mainstream Americans were eating when hippies started exploring these foods?
Yeah, well, I was looking at cookbooks from the 1960s just for some background. And a lot of the recipes at that point were combined cans and boxes. You know, this was a time when, like, the food industry had really gone into overdrive, inventing new additives and preservatives and packaged goods and stocking them into these new supermarkets. And so I think, you know, the diet of the day was a lot of meat and potatoes based for a lot of Americans. But then, you know, all of this sort of canned stuff that just really was nothing like their ancestors had eaten.
And so then how was the notion of, say, organic produce regarded? If that was even in the lexicon.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the word organic only made it into the United States in 1940. It was coined a little bit earlier in Britain. But it really was a sort of a fringe thing that only sort of, you know, freaky people believed in. There was this, you know, there were these constant reports. Anytime anybody talked about organics was just sort of like, why do they believe this? I have no idea. But, you know, the American food supply is really good for you. So
then why did hippies start doing this at all in terms of exploring these alternative foods if it was regarded in such a way?
Right. Well, I think it came up from a couple impulses. And one of them was that, you know, they were the first generation to grow up on processed foods and also, you know, organic agriculture that was, you know, sort of dependent on pesticides and fertilizers, chemical fertilizers. They were also the first generation to become aware of all of the downsides of those things. Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, about the dangers of DDT, which was
right.
The most used pesticide at the time, came out in 1964 when they were in their teenage years. And so there were a number of these reports that were coming out, and it combined with a more general malaise about the state of the nation and the news they were getting, or the information they were being sold by, you know, corporations and the government. And so they decided they needed to create a new diet by tossing out everything that had been given to them and really going back to the basics.
So essentially you're saying that that it was a political act in some ways. It was like a rejection of mainstream culture and of the messaging of the major power centers of the
U.S.?
Yeah,
in many, many ways. I mean, it really started off as a rejection more than a cuisine, you know. It started off with this idea, well, if we're going to rid ourselves of all of these chemicals and we're going to rid the food we grow has to be made without chemicals, then what's left? So, you know, whole grains and beans and, you know, just things that they had never grown up with, really.
And how did you define hippie? Like, what
right.
constituted a hippie?
Well, that word I learned because I was born in 1971. And so by the time I was, you know, growing up, hippie was just sort of this general ha-ha, you know, term. But I would talk to folks and use the term hippie food sometimes or use the word hippie. And I realized how charged it was. For a lot of people who were in the counterculture, that word hippie was associated with, like, dirt. dirty, smelly, long hair dropouts. And so a lot of the people I talked to, they, you know, they had long hair, they were back to the Landers, but they didn't sort of participate in the psychedelic culture of the Haight-Ashbury in the 1960s.
I see. So where, if you had to say a place of origin for hippie foods to emerge, I mean, there's a lot of it in California. Would you say California is sort of the place or?
California was one of the big crucibles, definitely, for a couple ideas. I mean, Southern California developed this health food scene and starting in the 1910s through the 1960s. And so a lot of the health food gurus were based there. And that health food scene developed all these products like brewer's yeast and wheat germ, and yogurt was very popular in health food circles, along with things like lecithin and carob, all of these alternate ingredients that then the counterculture adopted when they were, you know, looking for sort of healthier foods to eat.
Well, tell us about a local person that you highlight in your book called Gypsy Boots.
Yeah, Gypsy Boots. He is actually one of my favorite characters from the book. And I got to talk to his sons, one of whom lives in Pacifica, I think. And he was born in the Bay Area, but in the 1920s, I think. But he dropped out in the 1940s. He swears he lived in Golden Gate Park for a year before he traveled up and down the state, living in caves and canyons and picking fruit for a living. And in Southern California, he joined up with a group of people called the Nature Boys, and they all had long hair. They all lived sort of outdoors. They all were sort of raw foods, you know, folks. And Gypsy would have kind of remained on the fringe, peddling fruit and sort of selling, you know, sprout and carob sandwiches. But this talk show host named Steve Allen, who had a national talk show, his kookbooker found Gypsy Boots.
Kookbooker?
His kookbooker.
So he was just looking for anybody
looking for
that
crazy.
Was super kooky.
Yep. And he invited Gypsy on the show, and Gypsy was such a hit that he became a regular guest on the Steve Allen show and would be invited back once a month and was like the headliner sometimes. And he would like swing in on a vine or make, or like, you know, decorate Christmas trees with daikon and kiwi and then spout poetry and make juices and smoothies. And so he, you know, he had this national fan base.
Well, in one of the reviews of your book, I read one of the reviewers say that the next time you open a Kind Bar or a Cliff Bar, you can thank Gypsy Boots.
Yeah.
For that.
He also he had a Boots bar that was available in Southern California through the 80s that was nuts and seeds and grains. I mean, it was basically a Cliff Bar.
And then there was Jim Baker and his wife, Elaine. I think you wrote about Baker, who would, I guess, ultimately refashion himself as Father Yod. What
yep.
was his contribution to all this?
So, Jim Baker was interesting to me, not just because he became Father Yod, but because he was part of this. He sort of showed how the counterculture adopted these ideas from the 1950s. Jim and Elaine Baker had this sort of glamorous Whole Foods restaurant on Sunset Strip in the 1950s called the Aware Inn. But he ended up killing a few people. And got off in self-defense and then kind of spiraled down and then found spirituality and then ended up founding his own cult. So he had a group of 150 to 200 Southern Californian young folks like followed him. They all wore white. They lived together. They drove, you know, Rolls Royces. He ended up having 13 or 14 wives. And this restaurant was this raw foods restaurant that all of the rock stars and the stars
the
of the
Hollywood,
time,
yes.
Yeah.
The Hollywood crowd really took to his. Yeah. And so, as odd as he sounds as well, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that was interesting in your book was as you were profiling people, it was hard for you to kind of declare an original hippie or declare, because this was really something that was happening in multiple corners of the U.S. at the same time.
Yeah. And part of what was driving me to write about this was my own experience. And my parents were anything but hippies. They're, you know, politically liberal Mennonites who lived in a small city in Indiana in the 1970s. And Elkhart, Indiana.
I've actually been there. Yes.
Oh, wow. And we belonged to a co-op. They had a collective garden. I grew up eating like, you know, whole wheat bread and sprouts and all of the foods that I write about. And so my question was, how did my parents start eating this food?
And how did they start eating this food?
Well, they Mennonites had their own path toward this. In 1976, a cookbook called More with Less came out, and it was whole foods and recipes from Mennonites who'd done relief work abroad. And so all these internationally influenced recipes, but I grew up with, you know, all these lentil stews and tofu and broccoli stir fries and all of these dishes that in Indiana were just completely foreign to anything around them, but they were our everyday food.
And you said that More with Less in your book, that cookbook was informed by Diet for a Small Planet.
Yeah. Diet for a Small Planet came out of Berkeley. Francis Morlepay wrote it in 1971. And it really is kind of the cornerstone book for this movement. She was interested in solving global hunger and went looking at UC Berkeley in the library and looked through agricultural reports and determined that, you know, if Americans stopped feeding the grains and beans that they were feeding to animals for meat and fed them to humans instead, we could solve global hunger. So it set off this vegetarian movement across the country, but also was part of this way, you know, offered people this way of politicizing their food, of thinking of their food choices, what they bought at the grocery store as having political effects.
And did it really bring tofu into the mainstream as well?
It did. You know, so California is kind of unique in some of the coastal cities. We've had Japanese and Chinese American communities for 150 years who've been making tofu. But, you know, in smaller places like Indiana, it just wasn't something that they had. But there was a Zen monk from the Zen Center named Bill Shurtleff and his partner Akiko Ayayagi living in Tokyo. They read Diet for a Small Planet and got interested in teaching people how to make tofu because it was cheap, it was easy, it was a high, you know, good protein source. So they researched this book that has 500 recipes for tofu, and then they toured around the country promoting it. And at every one of the stops where they made, it was more than 40, a little tofu-making collective started up.
And that's why I emphasized actually at the beginning that it wasn't so much that hippies invented tofu so much as it was that, you know, I think you write that they reinterpreted essentially Japanese foods and then made them, disseminated them so that they became more mainstream as well, because I'm sure my parents wouldn't necessarily, you know, thank hippies for tofu that we had as kids. And speaking of you growing up, one of the things that I wonder about is whether or not you in any way felt sort of outside the mainstream with the foods that you were eating, because we've had people even among our staff who've talked about some experiences of parents being early adopters of hippie food and those kids having it really rough, like going to school with soy protein and alfalfa sprouts on whole wheat bread, you know, while the other kids are eating what were considered normal school lunches. Yeah. I mean, did you face any teasing or bullying as a result?
I had it easy. So my parents were not doctrinaire enough that they wouldn't, you know, necessarily always send me to school with stuff. But I do remember going over to friends' houses and they had sugared cereal and candy bars. And I was like, oh my gosh, why can't I have these good things? But some of my friends really had it bad. You know, they were sent to school with like mason jars full of three bean salad for lunch, and you know, everything they ate was brown, and nobody would trade with them. But there is definitely a generation of us who were traumatized.
Yeah, people were talking about the trauma of carob Easter bunnies. So can you remind us what carob is?
So carob is a chocolate substitute that was. Well, I mean, it was really the health food movement of Southern California who decided it was a chocolate substitute. It has a long and noble tradition of being sort of a sweet, carbohydrate-rich food, but not in America, where we decided that we needed to make carob chips and make carob brownies and carob Easter bunnies, and it tastes nothing like chocolate. So a whole generation of us who were fed this as kids think of it as this thing that we had to suffer because of our parents' health beliefs.
We're talking with Jonathan Kaufman. He's an award-winning staff writer for the San Francisco Chronicle about food, and his new book is Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. It looks back more than half a century at the fringe movements, the gurus, the colorful characters who brought what was once considered unconventional, even inedible foods, to the mainstream. Did you grow up eating hippie foods? How did they shape your childhood? Or were you one of these rebellious counterculture protesters expressing that through your eating? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. We're curious what this conversation is reminding you of or bringing up for you. You can post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, on Facebook. You can tweet us at KQED Forum, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Now, what were some of the wackiest things that they tried that didn't work? I mean, we were talking about carrot, but there were theories about food, right? I think you mentioned George Osawa and like this group of folks who came to Chico. You write about them and all about eating nothing but brown rice for a while.
Yeah. So George Osawa was this, he's a fascinating guy to me. He was another one of the people that I just really loved reading about. He was born in Japan in the turn of the last century, and he became sort of he joined a Japanese health movement that believed that the Japanese should return to a pre-Western contact peasant diet and they would be healthier. And so he brought his ideas to America in 1960, but he combined these ideas with this with his interpretation of yin and yang. And so he assigned certain foods to be yin and certain foods to be yang, but not in the same way that traditional Chinese medicine does. And then he would have these ideas. So he would teach Americans that, you know, diet was contributing to heart disease and obesity and diabetes, but also that if you ate brown rice for 10 days, you could bring yourself in union with the universe and cure disease in your body. So there were all of these young Americans who kind of gravitated toward his ideas, but before they knew what they were doing, they would give themselves scurvy.
Because they were not eating a very balanced diet. Wow. And also, you know, you talked about how like some of the carrots that they would grow would come out as like, yeah. I don't know what.
Well, they really took the idea of yin and yang to this degree that was like, it was Talmudic in its analysis of it. So a carrot would have a yin end and a yang end, and so you had to slice it on the diagonal so that you balance that within the carrot. You had to serve it with foods that were, you know, either more yin and yang to balance that. You had to cook it with a proper spirit in your heart because they believe that, you know, your mood transmitted itself into the food. It was pretty, it made eating sort of this spiritual practice but also a chore, I think.
Well, we talked about how some of this originated in Japan or some of these ideas came there. But one thing that really struck you as you were researching this book was how racially white the movement actually was, that it was overwhelmingly white and middle class. Why was that the case?
I think part of the reason was that the United States was 87% white and non-Hispanic at that time. But a large part of it, I think, was because I think the white counterculture had a lot of ideas about, you know, how they should be embracing a multicultural society, but didn't understand the mechanics. And what I often encountered was that there were parallel conversations happening in African American and white counterculture communities, but they weren't intersecting. So, for example, with co-ops, there's this long, amazing tradition of consumer food co-ops in African American communities because it was a way to often, you know, bring wealth when the financial systems were discriminating against them. And there's some talk that you know, there were food co-ops that were really active in the civil rights movement. But the counterculture food co-ops would open in African American neighborhoods, and they'd only be serving sort of, you know, these like sort of crunchy whole grains, and then people would complain that, you know, none of the folks from the surrounding community were coming into the store. So
yes, and also segregation, I mean, played a role, I guess. And then, and as you said, it wasn't that people of color were not involved in it, but that there were a lot of other things, too, going on, like other movements and areas of focus, like trying to address racism, discrimination. So, yes, well, we have got a lot of calls and comments coming in. One listener writes, tofu, carob, and brewer's yeast, my culinary heritage. And let's hear from Lori in Oakland. Hi, Lori.
Hi, how you doing? I just wanted to call and thank you for this great conversation because I was laughing thinking about the frozen yogurt that started in Southern California as a kid with carob chips, of course. And then fondly remembering the carrot juice phase in our family, where that was all that we were allowed to have as children, and we were all turning orange. So a lot of fun food memories from a Southern California counter food culture.
Well, Lori, thanks for that memory. How long did the carrot juice fast last?
Well, I think as soon as everybody realized that there was kind of an orange sheen that was happening that wasn't so good, that it did cease and desist. But it would probably fit in well with our political culture now. Maybe that's what's going on. I'm not sure.
Well, Lori, thanks for the call. Let's hear from Michael in Oakland. Hi, Michael.
Hi. There's this great CBC podcast called The Fridge Light, and it's all about sort of the strange backstories of food that we now take as being sort of routine parts of our diets. There's an episode called Green Gold, which is all about lettuce and salad greens, and it starts back way, way, way back to the development of iceberg lettuce and all the complications involved in shipping lettuce from California off to the East Coast, and how completely revolutionary it was to have fresh salad in the middle of winter in Manhattan. And then sort of strings by through the first sort of reintroduction of romaine lettuce into the diet. And then the crazy story, which is the part that I think most directly connects up with your book, of how we first got sort of a packaged baby salad greens, and how initially after niche California restaurants like Chez Panisse started offering these exotic greens, chefs on the East Coast started wanting them, and these elaborate packaging systems and then shipping them via airplane that organic farmers in Washington State and California were doing, like literally packaging the greens up within, like, paper bags, within plastic bags, within paper bags, shipping them via airplane to get them off the East Coast, and then finally taking advantage of technology that had been developed and patented but never used by some of the food giants.
Yeah, you've got Jonathan Kaufman nodding here with everything that you're mentioning.
Yeah, but even long before that, so I one of my chapters on the Back to the Land movement was about Vermont, and they were talking about, you know, the produce chain in the 1960s before these organic Back to the Land farmers started growing produce to sell. Was just repulsive, you know, by the time it made it all the way from California to Vermont. And so organic farmers there set up some of the first farmers markets to reopen in the state in 1975, 1976. And, like, they had to train chefs and train some customers how to work with fresh produce again.
Well, Michael, thanks for that call. And, it, you know, when you talk about distribution systems, it's part of also just how this thing moved around the country, and also the penchant for travel that the hippies had that you write about that really caused this to become more ubiquitous. We're talking with Jonathan Kaufman about his new book, Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 866-733-6786. We'll have more after the break. I'm Nina Kim. This is Forum.
Whole Earth Vitamin Bar, just sucking on my plain white yogurt from a hand-thrown pottery jar, and sipping a little hand-pressed cider with a carrot stick for dessert, and wiping my face in a natural way on the sleeve of my peasant shirt.
Let me hit that, get me near that crunchy granola sweet. Drop your shrink and stop your drinking, crunchy granola's neat.
This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about hippie food, meaning brown rice, alfalfa sprouts, energy bars, granola, whole wheat bread, foods that might figure prominently in your diet that were introduced to Americans by unusual women and men in the 60s and 70s who were often derided but ended up changing the way we eat today. Award-winning Chronicle food writer Jonathan Kaufman has written all about them and the counterculture politics of the day that fueled the rise of these then-considered unconventional foods in his book, Hippie Food, How Back to the Land Sanders, Longhairs, and Revolutionaries Change the Way We Eat. And you, our listeners, seem to have a lot of memories of this time. Share them with us at 866-733-6786. You can post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post comments on Facebook and Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. Did you grow up eating hippie foods? How did they shape your childhood? Or after hearing this, where's the hippie food influence strongest in your life? Roxanne writes, in defense of the moms and dads of baby boomers, they grew up during the Depression when a good diet was not guaranteed. Meals weren't even guaranteed. They were ready for the processed foods revolution, which would allow them to store tons of food in their homes. The dads had all just gotten back from World War I, where they ate K rations, heavily preserved, non-heated foods.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
And you were also talking about how the incomes of Americans did start to go up in the 50s, and that was really seen as progress to be able to afford the latest cool processed packaged food that was coming out.
And the price of food was going down, too. You know, and this was a time when people weren't eating out at restaurants very much. So really what you found in the grocery store was really what you were eating.
Well, Scott tweets, shake a puddin', space food sticks, tang. American food was artificial as blank. Good on the folk who brought real food back to Americans' diets. There was, though, a period, right, Jonathan Kaufman, where even though, you know, we talk about how a lot of this originated in the 60s and 70s, it's not like it really took off during the 80s. What happened then?
Right. In fact, you know, I think there were a lot of reverses in this movement in the 80s and 90s. In the 1970s, food co-ops and buying clubs and natural food stores just really exploded. At the end of the 70s, there were about 5,000 consumer food co-ops selling natural foods across the country. And in the 80s and 90s, that number shrunk down to about 300. So I think fashion moved on. But at the same time, these foods stuck around quietly in our homes and in cookbooks like the Moosewood Cookbook, which came out in 1977. You know, many people have been cooking those foods, and also they went into grocery stores. And so you began finding, you know, whole wheat bread at grocery stores in the 1980s where you didn't before. And so it was a quiet process of kind of sneaking their way into all of our lives as people realized they were healthy.
You also wrote that part of the reason that it died down was there was infighting in the community as well, in the hippie community, about, you know, food, not profits, things like that.
Yeah. The motto of the co-op movement was food for people, not for profit. And that was the motto that inspired, you know, hundreds of thousands of people to volunteer their time and start up co-ops and start eating these foods. But also, you had so much financial naivete. I mean, that you had all of these volunteers who were, like, starting up these little shops. And you know, maybe the bookkeeping, I was told, maybe, you know, the bookkeeping sometimes went to the person who wasn't at the meeting. So, you know, you had, and they were trying to make a go of it in the lowest profit margin industry in the United States. So, I mean, things fell apart really quickly.
So then what do you think it means to folks who may have started this or grown up and really embraced this, as you did to some degree, to see now that it's very corporate? I mean, Walmart, right, is the largest retailer of organic foods now. And you've got Whole Foods and you've got, I mean, these are massive corporations.
In some ways, it's a total betrayal of the entire anti-capitalist spirit of this movement, you know. But at the same time, you know, it really did change the way we eat. It offered an alternate path, I think, for people, you know, who didn't want to eat processed food. It created this whole channel, the sales channel, distribution channel, and so people have options to eat more healthfully and more, you know, ecologically than they did 50 years ago.
Yes, why you probably wrote both the revolution failed, the revolution succeeded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, let's hear from Zach in Alameda. Hi, Zach.
Hi there. I grew up in Kansas City was born in 1974. So by the time I got into elementary school in the early to mid 80s, my family, you know, was practicing yoga. We were recycling before there was curbside. And certainly the Diet for a Small Planet featured prominently in our household. And I have distinct recollections of going to school with my whole wheat bread and alfalfa sprout sandwiches, and the other kids, you know, pointing and kind of laughing at me, you know, what are you eating?
Wait, did you say whole wheat grass and alfalfa sprouts?
Well, whole wheat bread, but the other kids would say, he's eating grass sandwiches. And I actually got put in detention, like taken out of the lunchroom for creating a disruption because of, the teacher didn't care what was going on at the table. She's like, quit making a fuss.
Wow. Well, that is definitely a snapshot of in time of the culture.
I did read one news story that said that where a high school principal in Minnesota banned granola because he felt like it was too associated with the hippies and that meant drugs.
Well, exactly. Zach, thanks for sharing that memory. Leanne from San Rafael. Hi.
Hi. Good morning, everyone. This is a very, very reminiscent show at many levels. I appreciate it greatly. I grew up about 2 miles from D.C., and I was a little bit post-hippie. I was born in 1960, but at the time I was 1977, my boyfriend at the time turned me on to Survival into the 21st Century by Viktor Kolvinskis, and he purported everything from wheatgrass through vegetarianism, through veganism, through raw food, all the way up to the span of the most healthy diet being called breatharianism, literally where you didn't eat. And this was a big, big, big book in that same counterculture time. Mm. I used to have to drive to a different state to get to a health food store. Mm. I'd come home with my glass 5-gallon bottle of water with my entire family, as well as my entire high school, kind of scoffing at me. But I was curious if your author in the historical kind of looking back came across Viktor Kolvinskis and Wigmore was part of that wheatgrass movement or that book, because it was quite something during the time.
Leanne, thanks.
You know, I didn't read that book. I did come across Ann Wigmore, who was the person who introduced wheatgrass juicing to Southern California. I guess she was based in the East Coast, too, but to the health food circles in the 1960s. But
Well, Leanne, thanks for telling us about that. Amy tweets, many granola moms like mine were just an update of their anorectic mothers, obsessed with control via food and discouraging any joy via nourishment.
There was control was a huge part of this movement for good and for bad, because for a lot of people, it was about taking control of their health and taking control of their diet by, you know, if you were going to buy whole wheat berries and grind your own flour and make your own bread, you not rely on the packaged products at the, you know, at the food. It was a control, you know, but that also, right, there was this whole suspicion of joy that we kids felt because you weren't allowed refined flour or sugar or all these other things that, you know, seemed to make food so good.
And you talked about how taste was sort of secondary to the other parts of it. Well, let me go next to Peter in Castro Valley. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I was wondering if the author could draw any connections between what we see here in the Bay Area in the tech industry, the Soylent and the search for perfect nutrition in a single package, and connect that to anything they were doing back in the 50s and 60s.
Peter, thanks. Jonathan Kaufman?
Not directly. I mean, that definitely the idea of that sort of optimum nutrition through chemistry and food engineering was definitely a spirit of the times in the 50s and 60s. It was exactly what the counterculture was rebelling against. But the focus on superfoods and things like, you know, maca and all these new ingredients that are new to, you know, Americans ingredients that we're adopting in the hope of, you know, achieving personal health or that all dates back to L.A. in the 1910s through the 1930s.
What is, do you see another counterculture brewing in food right now?
What this book has really made me rethink my approach to food trends, like paleo, Whole30, even some of the excesses of the gluten-free movement that aren't connected to, you know, directly to health. It's made me think, well, you know, even if these kind of ideas, which are often a little specious, disappear, how are they going to change the way we eat in 30 years? Like, what ingredients are they introducing into the diet that we're going to completely lose all roots, but we'll be cooking with later?
Who do you credit with whole wheat bread?
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, you wrote about the diggers in San Francisco and how they made brown bread and things like that. But I was just wondering who you would credit with kind of being the the originator, if there was one at all.
Sure. Well, I mean, whole wheat bread was one of the first nutritional fights, the first, you know, anti-industrialized food fight that was happening in the United States. And that dates back to the 1830s with Sylvester Graham. And we know Graham's name because of Graham crackers and Graham flour, which he didn't invent. But he was arguing that, you know, that refined flour was unhealthy. He argued that it was because it was overstimulating, and the more you stimulated your nervous system, the more susceptible you were to disease. But that, you know, those ideas about brown bread became a really sort of a health food back then.
We're talking with Jonathan Kaufman. His new book is Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. And it looks back more than a half century at the fringe movements and the gurus who brought what was once considered unconventional food to the mainstream. Kaufman is also was also a former restaurant critic for the East Bay Express and the SF Weekly. So very local. And we're hearing your stories about growing up eating hippie foods and how they shaped your childhood. And the questions that come to mind based on anything you're hearing, you can share them at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can tweet us at KQED Forum or post comments on Facebook or our website, kqed.org/forum. Karen writes, I was that kid with the crumbling brown homemade bread covered with stiff additive-free peanut butter, a single carrot, and maybe an apple, longing for the white bread and bologna sandwiches and chips that my classmates brought to school. The highest compliment in our family about something my mom made was, "This tastes store-bought."
Oh, I feel for you, Karen.
And Susan writes, carob bread, lentil loaf, and tofu pie. Ugh. We thought we were so progressive by eating and pretending to like these food alternatives. I'm laughing at it now, pretending to like. One of the points that you stress in your book, Jonathan Kaufman, is that even though you grew up eating these foods and that you enjoy these foods, that this book really is not about advocating that one eat all these foods.
Right. I think, you know, what I wanted to talk about is the only way that people have talked about these foods in the literature that I was reading was, you know, how great they were for you or how horrible they were, you know, sort of poo-pooing the nutritional science or whatever the ideas that, you know, they embodied. And I just wanted to consider them, sort of step back and say, well, how did this change the way we eat?
And the other thing, too, that you talk about is how it also brought in more flavors from other parts of the world, which I thought was interesting. I mean, I'm reading, you know, these comments about kids who had to bring these crazy lunches to school. And I had that same experience, even though I wouldn't necessarily consider it hippie food, but just I would bring food to school that people were like, wow, that is really weird. Or that's, you know, that really smells awful. Mm-hmm. Right. That your parents would pack and just be like, oh, my God, I wish they would just pack something more normal for me in these. But it did make me think about how there was this parallel thing happening where a lot of the foods you describe as hippie foods are actually foods I was eating. That, you know, again, my parents wouldn't necessarily say they got the ideas from hippies to do that. And so can you talk a little bit about how this movement also just helped introduce Americans to other flavors?
Sure. I mean, part of that came from the macrobiotic movement. You know, that was sort of the first nutritional system that the counterculture adopted, and it was very based in Japanese flavorings. And so a lot of people learned to eat tamari, a word that George Osawa coined, you know, tamari and miso and umeboshi plums and, you know, through macrobiotics. But really what happened in the mid-70s was you had a whole generation of middle-class counterculture kids who were traveling for the first time because air travel became a lot cheaper. And there was this interest in the world beyond sort of the Americas that their parents' generation didn't necessarily share. And they were also cooking vegetarian food and all these new ingredients and had no idea how to make it taste good using like the American palate. And so they started pulling from cookbooks, from their travels, from, you know, ideas, from things they'd heard about, and creating their own interpretations of them based on with, you know, whole grains and all of the countercultural staples. So it tasted nothing like the original dish that they were trying to make, but it also tasted a lot better than, you know, some of the nut casseroles and sprout and bean things that they had originally tried to make.
Well, Nikki tweets, I'm black. I tried to be a vegetarian when I was a preteen in the late 60s. My single mom basically said we had more serious problems to worry about than granola and alfalfa. Green Giant niblets corn was the best I could do. Thanks for sharing that, Nikki. And let's go next to David in Oakland. Hi, David.
Hi. Thank you for having this conversation. It's really interesting. And I was wondering if, for your guest, if there's anything about California culture or Californians in general that you think has given rise to these food trends, and is there something about California that makes that happen?
David, thanks.
Yeah, well, I mean, Southern California, the reason I think Southern California was such a crucible for this sort of health food, and a lot of it was raw food, was because Southern Californians had access to it year-round. You could tell people that they should be drinking juice every day if you had a ready supply of oranges all year round. I mean, then that in the days when, you know, food transportation was really hard to come by, that was sort of new. But the other reason is, I think, in L.A. especially, L.A. started off, you know, in the late 1800s, it was a sort of a destination for people trying to get well. And so there was this culture of health and alternative health that developed there, and it combined with Hollywood and the focus on beauty in the 1920s and 30s. So this idea of you should be eating these super healthy foods that will make you more beautiful really came out of California.
Well, David, thanks for the question. And let's go to Wolfgang in the Russian River. Hi.
Russian River. Thank you. Yeah, very interesting and funny. Some of the pain we went through during those years we were growing up, myself being allergic to carrot and beet juice, and I used to drink it thinking, this has got to be healthy for me. And then my throat would swell up and I'd almost die. You know? And I was thinking of the analog of today's experience, where I was reading in the science news yesterday about how asparagus might contribute to breast cancer. And I'm thinking of all the dark matter in food that we don't know about yet, and how the hippie movement tried to one-size-fits-all, you know, give up bread, eat raw foods. So what do you think about this new asparagus research? I'll take my comment off the air.
Thank you.
Well, I think it's just part of this sort of trend we see of people reporting single subject studies that, you know, without necessarily having any context, and you know, we in the media, we like to talk about these things because they get lots of interest. But, you know, I think it'll take a lot longer to have any kind of conclusive information about whether asparagus is really bad for you.
Well, Wolfgang, thanks. Let's hear next from Judy in Tiburon. Hi, Judy.
Hi. My question for the guest is, he seems to be focusing, I haven't seen the book, but he seems to be focusing on Los Angeles as a center of perhaps the food, and the reasons are good. But I, having been here in the 60s, had a cousin who was with Stephen Gaskin, and we used to go down to the beach. I forgot what they call it. It's not there anymore. To Monday night class with Stephen Gaskin, who eventually rounded up tons of hippies, and they made a huge bus caravan, and they drove to Tennessee, where they did set up a farm, and not only eating well from there, but also primarily alternative lifestyles. And we visited them there because it was a cousin. And I remember the showers were outside and everybody showered naked. And then they had four-way marriages. Four people would get married. And it certainly was a California-centered hippiedom in
rural Tennessee.
I love
the farm. I got to visit it and talk to a bunch of people who belong to that movement. The farm, what I loved about I have a kind of a chapter that focuses on the farm, because one of the things they also did, they were vegan and they were growing their own food. And after a 3 or 4 really disastrous years, they really learned how to make soy milk. And they also learned from USDA scientists how to make tempeh, and they were provided the spores. So they became the center of tempeh making. They cultured spores themselves. They basically started the United States tempeh industry beyond a few small Indonesian communities, and they continue to make spores there in their labs that they sell to commercial tempeh makers.
Well, Judy, thanks for that. And Heather writes, my mom was also a health nut, so I grew up with organic foods, wheatgrass, etc. As an adult, I'm amused and annoyed in equal measure by friends who didn't grow up this way and who now proselytize to me about organic GMO cleansing, etc., as if they themselves have discovered this crazy unknown thing called healthy eating. Would you consider hippie food one of the most successful, I guess, remnants of the hippie movement?
I think it's the maybe one of the most longest the longest lasting, definitely, in terms of long lasting cultural change. Sure.
And you think that is because, I mean, the ubiquity of it, all of that, because?
Because I think the success of, you know, where this movement succeeded was in convincing the rest of us that creating a healthy diet and convincing their idea, sharing their ideas about what healthy food was with the rest of the country. And those ideas about health were adopted by everybody, you know, nutritionists since, and are now part of the USDA. If you look at the USDA daily guidelines, it says eat less sugar, eat less meat, eat more fruits and vegetables, tofu, tempeh, and other protein substitutes are healthy for you. And half of your grains should be whole grains. So it's basically the hippie food diet.
Well, Vadshah in Palo Alto. Am I saying your name right, Vadshah?
Yes, thank you.
What's on your mind?
Basically, what I wanted to ask is, during the same period, there was a widespread influence of Indian culture, like spirituality, etc., in America. And what I wanted to know is why there wasn't a similar level of influence of Indian spices and herbs and flavors in the diet of these folks.
Oh, I think there was, to a certain degree. I think, you know, it was this combination of curiosity and inspired in many ways by interest in Indian spirituality, and you know, which goes even back to the Beatles and sort of the devotion that American teenagers had toward the Beatles. And when the Beatles traveled to India to study spirituality, they kind of it got people interested in Indian aesthetics and Indian food, as well as some of the ideas. But like the curry, these really sort of rudimentary curries became a huge part of the counterculture diet.
Well, Vadshah, thanks for raising that. And Indrani says, I grew up in the 70s on the Stanford campus. Whenever I'd have a sleepover at one friend's house, they would take us to eat at Good Earth on University Avenue. The first time I was horrified. I ordered a peanut butter sandwich and it came on seeded bread with whole peanut butter, alfalfa sprouts, and wheat germ. P.S. What the hell is kombucha?
You know, the kombucha actually kind of comes afterward. That sort of hit the counterculture or the natural food scene in the 1990s, unfortunately. I want to know more about the roots of kombucha.
I know I'm seeing, like, there are, like, cocktails or drinks. Yeah. I don't know. But that's a good question. LaMeryl in El Cerrito, hi.
Hi. I was a young mother in the 70s, an older 31-year-old mother who raised two children on yogurt and sourdough starter and pancakes from sourdough starter. And we made pumpkin bread and ate fresh vegetables. And we rode around town. I had on long dresses, and I had a seat on the front of my bike and a seat on the back. And sometimes I had the baby and the pack on my back as we rode around.
So
So I was a hippie mother in both the towns in which my children grew up.
So do you feel vindicated when you hear Jonathan Coffin talking about this book and the enduring legacy of hippies and their food choices?
Oh, yes. I read all those books in the 70s and followed them for a while, but I'm a junk food, not an addict, but I love chocolate, so I do eat healthy, but I do like my chocolate. And our kids, my son loved his friend Marky because Marky's mother made cookies, chocolate chip, and I made whole wheat things that he liked Marky's much better.
Well, it's good to hear from you, LaMeryl. I want to ask you, Jonathan Coffman, as you said, as someone who grew up on this food and now writing a book about its origins in some ways, how has that informed or did it do anything in terms of you understanding your childhood better or just sort of shaping the way you look at it?
Definitely. I mean, a few ways. One is that I kind of forgave the counterculture for making so much food that I hated as a kid, because I realized how young a lot of folks were, and that they were adopting all these new ingredients that nobody knew how to cook and trying to teach themselves how to make it, you know. And so, of course, the food is not going to be that great at the beginning. And I think you know, the food as it's evolved over the past 50 years has become a lot tastier. And so the food I eat now is definitely vegetable-focused, whole grain-oriented, you know. But I think it's tastier.
And you were a food critic. I mean, you were a restaurant critic. I guess you still are, right, to some degree. And so how did that experience as a child sort of color the way you evaluated food?
Yeah, and that was one of the things, as I was just starting the research, to realize what an influence this food had on me. Because I think I have always thought about food as having political implications, our food choices, you know, and that dates back to that time. I grew up eating, you know, African stews one night and tofu stir fries one the next night, and then, you know, German sausage and sauerkraut the next night. And just that feeling that all of, you know, just that sort of, you know, comfort with eating a lot of different food and never feeling like food was strange or, you know, or foreign, I think comes from that time too.
So what would you like folks to walk away with if they read your book in terms of, you know, how hippies have influenced the modern American diet?
I hope they really, rather than, you know, I think we just naturally kind of poo-poo a lot of this food. I think we've been sort of trained to, because, you know, for 50 years we've been sort of poo-pooing it. Just to get a new appreciation for those choices that the counterculture was making, and think about all the ways that, you know, our ideas around health and our, you know, sort of interest in our ideals actually changes our diet as Americans.
Well, Daniel writes, I was born in 1952, one of five children. I asked my mother if she breastfed any of us. She was a great mom and cook, but her answer was, God, no, we had formula. A woman of her time. And that's so true, right? It is something that we so influenced by the time. Well, anyway, Jonathan Kaufman, such a pleasure to have you here talking with us about this today. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Jonathan Kaufman, San Francisco Chronicle food writer. The new book is Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. Have a great weekend. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.